You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to SS Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 20th of March, 2017, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. As always, I have my trusty co-host with me, Subal. Subal, how are you doing today?
I'm all right, thank you very much.
Excellent, excellent. That's good to hear. We've had a good week last week of news. I think a lot's going on. We had the Dutch elections where people seem to think that Geert Wilders hadn't done too well. They've been saying, oh, it's a triumphant win for the Liberals and the far right have lost. But I don't think we lost at all, like, because he increased by four seats in Parliament, which I think was pretty good. Yeah, so not too bad, all in all. And then we had this fantastic press conference with Merkel and Donald Trump, where Donald Trump refused to shake her hand, which I thought was very good, a very good sign. And he said about immigration and that moving to another country is a privilege and not a right. It's not a human right to just go to whatever country you wish. It only seems to be a human right if it has a female in charge of the country, like Merkel and like Theresa May, although Theresa May has been showing some signs of improving, which we're probably going to talk a little bit about later. And also at this press conference, he said that Germany hadn't been paying enough towards NATO, which seems to be mainly what the newspapers are concentrating on. But I just think the best bit of it about it was him reiterating his stance on immigration and saying that the well-being of the citizens of the country should always come first. And obviously in Germany, the German people are not being put first. We've had countless attacks, countless rapes, attacks, violent attacks. We've had suicide bombs going off outside buildings. We've had people being chopped up in train carriages. Horrific, violent crimes occurring in Germany that you just never would have thought possible in Europe 20 years ago. And yet they're a regular occurrence now. And it's all because of Merkel just opening up the gates and saying to the whole world, well, you can come in. And the rest of the world seems to think that this applies to them wherever they are. They can go wherever they like. And they're claiming that it's a human right for them to go to America. And that Donald Trump, by saying that these six or seven countries on the list that export terrorism, by saying that they aren't allowed to come into America, it's somehow going against their human rights. And this is the other issue that happened last week. He put forward that bill again, the anti-Muslim bill that people call it. Although it's not anti-Muslim, it's anti-terrorism. And they left the words Muslim off it, they reworded it. And yet they're still saying, the judges are still saying that they're not going to enforce this order from the president because he said some mean words about Muslims when he was on the campaign trail. And this is unprecedented, really, isn't it? Really is.
Yeah, I mean, it's taken common law to a whole new level, isn't it, really? I mean, it doesn't matter what the president says anymore. If the judges, you know, pass their judgment, then who cares? I mean, who cares what the people did? Who cares who the people elected or what kind of mandate the president does? If some judge in California says that you should open the borders and allow millions of people to flood into your country, then obviously you should let it happen. So, no, I don't think that's going to last. I think we're all just waiting for the next big terrorist attack, and then Trump will bring the hammer down, basically. I mean, that's what I'm assuming his plan is. In regard to Angela Merkel and the whole NATO issue, I think it's I didn't used to like NATO, but now that Trump's in power, I think NATO's fantastic. I mean, as far as I understand it, there's like 60,000 American troops posted in Germany. I googled this years ago. I haven't checked the statistics, but as far as I remember it, there's a lot of American soldiers in Germany. and a lot of American soldiers all over Europe. And why? Let's say when the summer heats up and the migrants start pouring in again, why can't Trump just send in the Navy and stop them coming in into Italy? Stop them coming in through the Greek islands. I mean, that's what NATO's for. It's to protect Europe. So, but you know, maybe in a few months' time, if once the Muslim bans come down and a few more terrorist acts, and maybe if Trump's won a bit more of his battle with the deep state and he's got more of control, perhaps he could do that. Maybe we should start lobbying Trump to just bring out the Navy and stop these flipping migrants from coming in.
Well, we could also use those American troops that are based in Germany. 60,000 American troops could use them to help the police force to police the crimes of these immigrants that are over there. I would love to see NATO actually being put to good use to protect Europe from the invasion force. But instead of that, we've just had this week, Britain has sent over the largest amount of troops since the start of the Cold War over to Estonia. And the reason for this is to counter Russian aggression. They haven't actually told us what this aggression is. Have Russian troops invaded Estonia? Have they invaded the Baltic countries? No, nothing of the sort. The Russian troops have done nothing whatsoever. And yet it's being reported that us sending over thousands of British troops is to counter Russian aggression. And it seems to me that it's NATO that is coming out with all the aggression. I mean, placing all these British troops on the border with Russia, obviously American troops as well, troops from all over Europe, yet there's been nothing in the news of anything aggressive that Russia has done. And when they get questioned about this, they just talk about this referendum that they had in the Crimea, which was, you know, 2-3 years ago, I think that was by now. And you could hardly call that aggression when over 90% of the country votes for reunification with Russia. And just 70 years previous, it was a part of Russia anyway. It's always been a part of Russia, Crimea. It was only a part of Ukraine because Stalin signed a bit of paper 70 odd years ago. So I really don't see what aggression at all Russia is guilty of. It just seems to me like they're poking a bear with a stick, with a sharp stick. But that seems to be all that NATO is used for the time being. So that would be a fantastic idea if we could get Trump to actually use those forces for something positive, I think, Subal.
Yeah, the Jews, they really hate Putin. And I know, it's kind of amazing because Putin's not even really that radical. I mean, he's more of a, seems like more of a mainstream, you know, ordinary kind of empire type conservative. Or maybe he's got a more radical side, but he doesn't want to bring it out. But he seems to just be trying to make peace all the time. He certainly hasn't. I mean, he has clamped down on the Jews, but not as much as I'd like him to. I mean, as far as I understand it, he recently made it illegal to criticize the Holocaust. I'm not 100% on that, though. But yeah, they really hate Russia. Interesting that you mentioned the British Army. I was reading in the Express today, which is a Jewish-owned paper, but I was reading the Express that apparently morale in the British Army is just at an absolute all-time low. People are just quitting left, right, and center. They can't get people to stay in the army. They're just dropping out all over the place. There's no joy in the army anymore, apparently, because they're being made to jump through so many hoops, and because they're taking, they're stripping away. Before, if you joined the army would look after your family. They're not doing that anymore. I'm not sure 100% about the details, but morale is at an all-time low. And I just wonder how long they're going to be able to continue to abuse us in this way.
Well, also the if you're in the army, it must get pretty depressing that the army isn't being used to actually defend the country.
That was the point. I remember now. Sorry, the point. Yeah, the tank chasing. That's it. The flipping tank chasing lawyers. Yeah, that's what really broke the morale. All these newspaper stories. with people who have fought in wars 10, 20 years ago, and all of a sudden they get some Jewish law chasing after them, trying to fail for just, you know, finding a war, which probably was being fought for Israel anyway. So, yeah, morale is smashed.
I think the lawyer that was doing that, I think he's been discredited and struck off for using false evidence as well. So that must be...
That was actually a great victory for us. And I didn't see anybody do an article on it. But, Jewish lawyer, yeah, he got struck off. Yeah, fantastic.
And I think Putin's anti-Holocaust speech law was more to do with revisionism, because they have this great patriotic war myth that they have in Russia, this great nation-building myth that holds the whole of Russia together, that they fought on the good side during the war. They were invaded by the evil Nazis, and the brave Russian Red Army liberated the rest of Europe, and they have this every year they have this huge celebration of that. And I think he's more worried about that being undermined, and also because if Holocaust revisionism could be used by the American state to subvert Russia in the same way that Moscow pays for Antifa organizations in the Baltics to destabilize the countries there. America has used the ultranationalists in the Ukraine to destabilize the Ukraine. And part of nationalism is Holocaust revisionism. And that could be used to undermine the Russian state. So I think that might have something to do with Putin changing that law, because they know what the Jews are like. They know what the Jews did to Russia and to the Russian people. They know what the Jews did to the Ukraine. So I don't really think it's fear of gas chamber myths being exploded that has caused that law to be put in place. And just where you were talking then about how you can't see what it is that they've got so much against Putin. They make him out to be far more extreme than he is. I think this is a tactic of the left now. They make Donald Trump out to be this extreme fascist, racist, which he isn't. He's just a civic nationalist. They make Putin out to be anti-Semite. The same with Donald Trump. And just today, or yesterday, we've had Tim Farron from the Liberal Democrats, the guy who nobody knows who he is, the leader of the Liberal Democrats. He's calling Theresa May part of this new right, this new fascist force, Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, Geert Wilders, and Theresa May. Mm. I you can hardly say that.
Theresa the new May face of fascism.
Yeah, the female face of fascism. Well, we have got a female face, actually. We got Marine Le Pen. And when you were just talking then about another terrorist atrocity, I really don't like to sound like I'm hoping for terrorism, but if there is any more terrorism, it would be good if it took place in France, I think, to help her.
Well, they had an incident just yesterday, didn't they, with the gunshots, so that some Muslim guy grabbed a machine gun off a policeman, started shooting people. They had to shoot him. It's in the papers this morning because William and his Jewish wife are in Paris talking to So actually, interesting enough, they're in Paris talking to survivors of the Paris massacre. Yeah, that's what they were doing. And I opened up the paper and I saw a photo, and they're talking to some black lady, which I just thought the whole thing was just highly amusing. First of all, they're in Paris talking to victims of the Paris massacre, and then at the same time there's a terrorist act. And then the victim of the terrorism that they talked to was a black lady. So anyway, the whole thing was, utterly convoluted. But I do know what you mean. I mean, I'm also praying for terrorism. I think it's great every time the Muslims blow something up. I'm really happy. I'm happy. I mean, I'm angry, but at the same time, it's like, good. Go crazy. Because if the Jews had any sense at all, they'd just wait. Because demographics is destiny. If the Jews had any sense at all, they'd play ball with Donald Trump and they'd just cool off for 10 years and make it seem like everything's okay, and they close the borders in Europe and allow the populist revolution to die off. Everybody would be like, oh, it's okay, blah blah blah, but it wouldn't be okay because the Muslims would still be breeding and people people would still be miscegenating. And then in 20 years' time, you know, we'd the whole thing would collapse. So, but maybe they can't. Maybe that's just their nature. They have to push forward, 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 forward. Maybe they know that if there is just a slight pushback, then the right will just keep pushing right. So maybe that's why they keep pushing forward.
I think that's all they know how to do is to just keep pushing for whatever is harmful to the white race. I mean, that's their reason for being. That's their reason. That's what I personally believe, that is their reason for being in the world. They represent the forces of darkness, the forces of chaos, and we represent the forces of light and order. And we learn from resisting all their temptations. We learn who we really are and what we're capable of, and we increase in our virtue. So in that way, even though they serve evil, they serve wickedness, it actually increases the general good in the effect that it has on us when we resist it. That's the way that I see it. It's almost like the Druidic way. They said that there was no evil in the world that isn't actually part of a greater good in the effect that it actually has. So I see them as seem more like a cosmic force, as it were, that we resist against. So they can't just look at it and say, well, hang on, we'll just hold back for 10 years and let them have their little populist uprising and then it will swing back to the left again, because they're not capable of actually doing that. They're not capable of making choices like that. Almost like an animal, I guess, with an animal instinct, you know, the instincts that animals have, and they just instinctively know how to behave. I see that in the Jews. It's an instinctive thing with them rather than a learned behavior, because it doesn't matter if they've been brought up to be Jewish in the Jewish religion or if they've been brought up to be atheists, they're still going to behave in the same way no matter what. Even if they've been brought up to be Christians, even if they're crypto Jews or conversos, they're still going to cause all the same problems as if they were religious Jews or atheist Jews or Bolshevik Jews. It's a racial problem, not a religious one, not a cultural one. A lot of people try to say that it's a cultural one, and if we could just change the way that they think, teach them, educate them, then they would be fine. But the church tried that, and look what it did to the church. Destroyed it.
It's interesting you mentioned the temptation thing, because it's not something which you find very much in India. We just don't phrase it like that. In the Christian religion, when they talk about the devil, they very much frame it as a temptation. Like there's somebody whispering in your ear, you know, tempting you with sex or with drugs. And it very much sounds like a Jew, doesn't it, really? Whispering in the ear of the king.
It is. It is the Jew.
But in India, it's not seen like that at all, because they don't have Jews in India. It's just seen more like, I don't know, it's just Maya. It's just the material world. You just sink into it and do bad things. But it's, maybe that happened because of the Jewish people. It's very interesting. But it's true what you say about the Murano Jews. I've been doing a lot of reading recently, because I got, as you know, blocked out of my YouTube account, so I just started doing a lot of reading. And the founder of the Jesuits was a Jew, Jewish by blood. And I was reading about him. He was he actually seems quite sincere in his Christianity. I mean, he said that his childhood heroes were El Cid and what was the other guy called? Rolo or Rolando, which is apparently some medieval French hero. And maybe King Arthur as well. He had like these Aryan role models, you know, and he was quite a military man. He liked to fight, but he had Jewish blood. He was a Jew. And he made a whole book about meditations that you can do about Jesus, like this kind of like mental arithmetic. He seemed like dedicated Christian, but he had that blood, you see. And what did he do? He created the Jesuits, and they caused so much chaos. I mean, they were kicked out of like 80 different countries. And because of his Jewish blood, the Jesuits were also open to accepting other Jewish so-called converts to Christianity, because obviously the Jesuits appeared around the time of the, you know, the end of the Reconquista, and Ferdinand and Isabel were forcing everybody to convert to Christianity. They forced all the Jews to convert, or they kicked them out. Anyway, so they took on all these Jewish converts, and look what they became, basically a terrorist organization, a terrorist Catholic organization causing all kinds of havoc. And what was the other example I was reading? A Dutch Jew who worked for the Dutch East India Corporation, one of the great original multinational corporations of the world. Some people say it was the first. I think the British East India Company was actually established in 1600, so it was a year before, but it wasn't exactly established like a corporation. It was just, anyway, whatever, it's just technical details. But anyway, one of the Jews that worked for them, he was also a converted Jew, Christian, seemed quite devout, talked about God all the time, but he had this utterly rampaging fanatical outlook. And he went to Indonesia and just started genociding the natives. You know, I mean, the Dutch went there originally to trade, and then they put this guy there in charge as the governor general, and he just starts slaughtering them all, you know, just absolute like, just power and fury. So yeah, it's blood. Yeah. You know, this is probably the great mistake that Christianity has made through the centuries is trying to convert these things. I was also reading about Napoleon and how he fought the Jews, and Napoleon didn't really fight the Jews, but he did fight the banking interests and establish his own bank without the whole, you know, usurious concept. And yeah, he tried to assimilate the Jews as well, and they ended up stabbing him in the back. So no, it don't work. No, you've got to get him out.
I think, Ignatius Loyola?
That's it. Yeah, I can't remember his name. That's it.
That was his name. Well, you always get exceptions to the rule. Yeah, and this is the problem, because people see the exception to the rule and they think, oh, well, the rule doesn't exist. They see people like Ignatius Loyola, and he seems to be a loyal Christian, and he seems to be very devout, very pious. He sets up an organization, and because of that, they hold that up as the example of the converted Jew, whereas 99% of them are just going to be as ruthless and anti-Christian and anti-white as all the other Jews. But because of that one prominent one, people don't think that, because we're always inclined to see the best in people, which is good if it's confined to our own race. If you always see the best in your own people, then that's a positive attribute. That helps with nation building, and it helps with looking out for other people. It helps to be charitable to other people and be merciful and all these other human traits that we have as white people. But when they get extended to these other races, then they get used against us. They are natural altruism. So when we see exceptions to the rule, we have to realize it's an exception to the rule. You get lots of black exceptions to the rule. And this was used a lot by the abolitionists. They would put these trained Negroes that could read. And they were usually mulattoes. They usually had a lot of white blood in them, which is why they had a higher IQ. And they would say, look, this is what a freed Negro is capable of. They can obtain a doctorate, they can obtain exams. And they would have them on the stage reading a poem or being able to talk properly. And people were bamboozled by it. And they thought, well, the Negro could be just like us if we freed him, if we just educated him. And then it goes on from that to, if we just started up affirmative action, if we just lowered the test results needed, if we just had quotas for the amount of blacks that we have in the workforce, if we just lowered the amount of crimes that they have to commit before we can allow people into the police force. All these things stem from that, from seeing exceptions to the rule and thinking that the rule no longer exists. It's a serious problem.
Yeah.
Serious problem.
Yeah, whenever you talk to a leftist, and you point out the Islamic problem or the Jewish problem or the black problem, you always get the same reply over and over again. I know some guy who's a nice black guy, a nice Indian guy, a nice Muslim, etc., etc. You know, it's like, well, yeah, sure. I know nice people who are I know a lot of nice Indians. I know a lot of nice black people. I don't hate them. I mean, I spent half my life traveling around the world living with these people. But, you know, you just got to look at the group behavior. You got to look at the way these people behave as a group. And if you're really honest, and because like I say, I know these people. If you really talk to them and have a good, honest conversation with them, you'll find out pretty soon that their loyalties really lie with their own people. Even the nice ones, nice Indians, they live in England. You know, they go to university, they get a nice middle class job, they don't break the law, they're good citizens. But you talk to them, their loyalties lie with Indian people, and ultimately with their homeland, really, and with their people. And you won't get them to sympathize with issues like white genocide, or, you know, the white working class is getting wiped out. You won't get them to sympathize, not in any meaningful way. They might say, oh, yes, well, but they're never going to side with you. And why should they? Why should they betray their own race to help out our race? They should be loyal to their own race. So this is really the problem. This is how I always explain it to people when people talk about good Jews and et cetera, it's like, well, yeah, maybe they're good, but the point is they're loyal to their own race, and that is moral, and that is righteous, to be loyal to your own people. And this is why we're being conquered, because we're not being righteous anymore. This is why many times, you know, sometimes I say that I like the Muslims more than I like white people, because at least Muslims protect their own women, you know. I mean, obviously I don't, but you know what I mean? You can see at least the Muslims protect their own women. What do these white men do when they're sitting on the TV and they hear about the latest Pakistani gang rape? What do these white politicians do? They don't do anything. They're utterly spineless and weak, and they're disloyal to their own race. It's disgusting. It's immoral.
Well, I think these other races are there for us to learn from them. The Muslims are there to as a scourge to punish us when we don't do the right thing. And the same with the Negroes, when they ban homosexuality, ban sodomy, that should really shame us, because we're the ones that are supposed to be the moral guardians of the world, upstanding and upholders of the law, and yet we're being shamed by these third world nations that have more morality than we do, where we've sunk so low. So I see these other races as people being there that we're supposed to learn from. We're not supposed to copy them. We're supposed to do the opposite of them. And where they've tried to copy us, and now we've fallen down so low, we're being shamed by it. And when you talk about the fact that they have their loyalty to their own race rather than to their new homeland, we've had a really good example of that this week with Erdogan and these Turks that are in Europe that he wanted to address in Holland, that he wanted to send out one of his ministers to talk to a Turkish rally in the middle of Holland with them all waving their Turkish flags, and in Germany, and where they were banned from actually talking to them. And he's come out with all these insults, calling Holland Nazis and having a go at Germany. His latest one is to tell all the Turks in Europe that they must have 5 children. Now, in Turkey, he tells all the Turks that they must have 3 children because they want to increase their number. But the Turks that are in Europe, he's told them that they must have 5 children, and they must make their new homeland into their new motherland. And they must take over by demographics, the demographic destiny, and then they'll be able to get their own back on all the nasty racist Europeans who have been oppressing them. Now, I'm paraphrasing a bit there at the end, but that was the essence of his speech. He's quite open about it. telling the Turks that they need to breed more, and then just by demographics alone, they will be able to conquer Europe. And this is what Muslims have wanted to do right since the very start. It's been about a religion that conquers other countries and forces the other nations to submit to their way of life, and then destroys the nation's genome by interbreeding with them. And this is what happened in the Middle East. This is what happened in the areas of North Africa that were white. The Muslims moved in there and they destroyed the genome of the nation and forced them all to become Arabs and interbreed with them. That's the way Islam works. And it's still exactly the same today. I was so shocked when Theresa May talked about this wonderful friendship that we've had with Turkey for hundreds of years. You look at what the Turks did in Bulgaria and what the Ottoman Empire did to the white Christians that were left in Asia Minor and to the white Christians that were in the Balkans. It's absolutely horrific. And you've got Theresa May saying, oh, they're great buddies. I mean, it's less than 100 years ago that they committed a huge massacre of the last remaining white Christians that were in Turkey. I momentarily forget the name of the place, but it was a very famous Christian centre. And they massacred them all. And the British fleet was just off the shore and did nothing about it. So they've always wanted to conquer Europe. And they can see that their destiny is to conquer Europe with demographics. And what he's saying is, don't blow yourselves up. There's no need for all this terrorism. All you have to do is make lots and lots of brown babies. And if you can find white women to have your brown babies with, then that's even better. And these mullahs and these imams have said this so many times. Go out and get yourself a white woman, and then the children will have beards and wear hijabs, and they'll be ours. So they don't need to blow themselves up. That's impatience to actually do that, is them being impatient. But again, it's part of nature. It's a part of the cosmic law that everything wants to go back to the center and what is natural. So when they first come over, they look a little bit odd, and we should think, well, hang on a minute, they don't speak the same language, they don't look the same as us, they don't dress the same as us, they don't have the same culture as us, they shouldn't be here. But we don't send them back, then the crimes start increasing. You start getting the odd mugging, then you start getting the burglaries, then you start getting the rapes, then you start getting the mass rapes and the rape gangs, then you start getting the terrorism, and it will continue to increase until either we send them back or we are defeated by them. It's just the laws of the universe.
Yeah, it's blood on the streets, and it's like Enoch Powell said. But I think, at least we've reached a point where no truly rational man can argue that it's a good idea anymore. I mean, the only argument they have against white nationalism now is just pure, just pure emotional nonsense, just garbage, just shouting and screaming racist. I think perhaps, perhaps 70 years ago when they opened the gates in, 1948, perhaps some Christians in this country, some of the more tolerant people on the right wing, perhaps everyone was against it. Perhaps there was perhaps an argument that, maybe it'll be all right. I don't know. Maybe they'll integrate. Maybe we could sort it out. I don't think that's an argument anymore. Not that any serious person can make anyway. So it very much reminds me of a story. I'll tell you, do you want to hear a story, Sven? Do you want to hear a parable? I'll tell you a story.
Yeah, tell us a parable.
Oh, okay. It's the story of the monkey and the king.
I love this one. Go on. It's brilliant.
Yeah. All right. So it's an Indian story. And the story goes that there's a king and he's sitting on a throne. And, he's got his court people surrounding him. And into the court walks a monkey. And this monkey's very humble. And he pays his obeisances and he puts his head to the floor. And he's extremely humble. And then the king, he just looks at the monkey and he gets off his throne and he just, boom, and he kicks him right out of the throne, right out of the court. And this happens every single day until one of the court Brahmins, the court intellectuals, he turns around and he says to the king, why are you doing this? He's just a young boy, he didn't know anything. Why are you doing this? It's so cruel. And the king says, oh, well, I have to. He says, all right, I'll show you. I won't kick the monkey. So the first day comes, the monkey comes in the room, pays his obeisances. He's very humble, looks around. The king doesn't kick him. He's like, oh, okay. And goes out again. The king says he'll do it for a week. And the second day, the monkey comes in. He pays his obeisances. He's looking at the king. And he's like, oh, the king's not kicking me. And then now he's looking around the room. He's got a little bit of a smile on his face. He walks back out again. The third day, the monkey comes in. He's not paying his obeisances anymore. Right? Now he's just sitting at the corner of the room and he's just hanging out. He's not really disturbing anybody, not yet, but he doesn't pay his obeisances. The fourth day, the monkey comes in. Now he's disturbing everybody and he's pulling at people's cloth. And he's, I don't know, if you haven't been to India, you don't know how monkeys are, but they're really annoying. He's pulling them, prodding them, running around the room, disturbing people. The fifth day he comes in, he's running around, he's harassing the women, he's causing havoc. The sixth day he comes in, he's crapping everywhere, he's attacking people, he's biting them. The seventh day, and he's sitting on the throne. Okay, that's the story of the monkey and the king, right? So then on the eighth day, the king kicks him and kicks him out. So what's the moral of the story? The moral of the story is that back, at the beginning of the 20th century, the Jewish century, things like, I don't know, women's suffrage, okay, look like a good idea. You look at the suffragettes, you see the way that they dress in their nice skirts and nice dresses. They look quite dignified, look quite nice. They had a reasonable argument. They were like, look at us, we're dignified, chaste women. We deserve a vote too. But, 100 years later, they're parading down the streets naked on a slut walk. You can say the same thing with gay marriage. Or just homosexuals in general. The first homosexuals were, again, dressed in a nice suit, looked very nice. We just want, to do what we do in private. We don't want to disturb anybody. Next thing you know, you've got gay marches, and now transsexualism, and now you're teaching kids to become transsexuals. You could say the same for the civil rights movement, right, with the blacks. Specifically in America. I mean, the first blacks, they were very educated, wearing suits, looked very dignified. And now look at the state we're in. So it's the same thing. That's how they hoodwinked our people 70 years ago or 100 years ago. The women were respectable. The homosexuals were respectable. The blacks were respectable. The immigrants were respectable. But they're monkeys, You don't kick the monkey. If you don't keep them down, then they're just, their real nature will come out. And this is what we've seen over the course of the last century. Their real nature has come out. There is a reason that we have a patriarchy. There is a reason that we keep these people out of our country. There's a reason that we repress homosexuality. I'm sure that many people are born with a genetic, desire for sexual perversion. It probably is natural inside me, but it's something we need to repress for a reason. Because if you don't repress it, if you don't kick the monkey, then 70 years later, 100 years later, your civilization is going to be torn to pieces.
If you don't kick the monkey, he'll be sat on the throne.
He'll sit on the throne, that's it.
It's discrimination, isn't it? You have to discriminate between what is good and what is evil. And the real knowledge, real insight comes in seeing that and knowing that and knowing, looking at the suffragettes, that it doesn't matter if they look reasonable, if their arguments are reasonable. You can't allow them to have the vote and have a say, because fast forward 100 years and they'll be sat on the throne. And they are. And look what Merkel's done to Germany. Look at what Sturgeon is doing to Scotland, and we've got a female leader of Plaid Cymru as well, and now we have a female leader of Sinn Féin. All these women sat on the throne, destroying the country with loyalty not to British people, but loyalty to females everywhere. And that comes above their loyalty to the British people. I mean, you could see this. There was I forget what it was. It was some kind of a debate. It was either a Brexit debate or a leadership debate. And they had Sturgeon there, and they had a couple of other female leaders of different parties. And they all ganged up on the man that was there. And they said, oh, us women together. Because that's the way that they think. And the white man does what thinks of men, women, and children, and the nation, and puts them first. And women put females first, of all kinds. It doesn't matter if they're if they're negresses, doesn't matter if they're mongoloids, it doesn't matter what they are. If it's a female, that's their loyalty. It's the females against the patriarchy. And that causes harm to the nation because they're going to put themselves first. The white man doesn't put himself first. He puts others first because his instinct is to protect and provide for others, whereas female instinct is to take what others provide for them and use it. Yeah, this is why women are good homemakers. This is why the women bring the children up, because that's their role. That's the role that they're supposed to be doing. That's what they're good at. That's what they excel at. And men excel at providing for the women and the family and protecting them. So you need to have men in charge and not women in charge. If you put women in charge, it's the equivalent of putting the monkey on the throne. And this is where we are today. I think that's a wonderful parable. I've heard it before. I know you have it on, you used to have it on your old YouTube channel. But yeah. All these old stories like Aesop's Fables, there's a lot in that, a lot of truths in that. The scorpion and the frog, that's another very, very truthful one.
Tell us that one. I don't know it.
Well, the scorpion comes across to a river one day, and he sees the frog there, and he says, "Mr. Frog, can you take me across to the other side of the river?" And the frog says, "Well, you're a scorpion." And the scorpion says, "Oh, yes, but we're all animals together. We're all animals together." And the frog says, "Yes, but you're a scorpion, and you'll sting me if I take you across to the other side of the river." And the scorpion says, no, I won't sting you. I won't sting you. If I sting you, then we'll both drown. So I won't sting you because I want to get to the other side of the river." And the frog thinks about it, and he thinks, actually what he's saying is true. If I do take him across the other side and he does sting me, then that'll be both of us dead. And he obviously won't want to kill himself. He can't want to kill himself because he obviously wants to live. He wants to get across to the other side of the river. So the frog says, "Okay then, Mr. Scorpion, I'll give you a lift if you promise not to sting me." And Scorpion says, "I promise I won't sting you." And they get halfway across the river, and then the scorpion stings the frog, and they both drown. And the moral of the story is, the scorpion, it's in the scorpion's nature to sting. It doesn't matter if it's going to kill him. It's just in his nature to do that. And that's the same thing that we see with the Jew. It's in their nature to destroy things, even if they destroy themselves. I mean, look at what they did once they took over the Soviet Union. They destroyed it. They could have ruled the world with that, but they didn't. They just destroyed all those countries that were part of the Soviet Union. So you have to look at what's in the nature of the race. If you look at what's in the nature of the Negro race, it's not in the Negro race's nature to save for a rainy day. It's not in their nature to think of what's going to be happening in the future. It's in their nature to be very sleepy, and it's also in their nature to dance around a lot and party a lot. It's not in the nature to do much else.
Don't worry, be happy, innit?
Yeah. And if you put them in among us, among white people, white people aren't so outgoing as the Negroes are. You see, this is why the Negroes with the white women, they'll go straight up to the white women, they'll chat them up. They won't have any shame. They won't have any embarrassment. White young white boys, they'll be embarrassed. They won't be able to be so forward as the Negro. And the white women see the Negro as, because he's being forward and he's not being embarrassed, they're attracted to that. Because in the white male, that's an alpha male sort of thing. But in the Negro, he's just like that because he has no shame. That's the difference. Yeah.
Well, they don't blush, do they? It's also interesting. I was listening to a podcast, and they were talking about the mating habits in Africa, and there was no concept of marriage before the white people turned up, before the Christians turned up. You just had a situation. They'd live in these huge huts in a village, and everyone would just have sex with everybody else. And, you know, a bunch of babies would come out, and they'd run around the village and basically get raised communally, and they'd eat communally, and everything was basically communist in a way. It was like the whole communal thing. But everybody would have sex with everybody else, and the key, I think, is that the black men, they don't protect their women, and they're not jealous about their women. Like, if you want to piss off a white guy, you go and talk to his girlfriend, right, or his wife. That'll annoy him, because white men are jealous. White men will protect their women. Black men, they just don't think in the same way. It's just biologically not their nature. I mean, and they come to our countries, and then they just perform exactly the same behavior. They live on the welfare, and they're all having sex with everybody, you know, with each other, creating lots of kids with no fathers. And then the black guys, they form gangs, and they'll have a group of girls which hang out with their gang, and they'll just pass the women around. But that's what happens to a white girl if she gets involved, you know, with black gangs. She'll be screwing one guy, and then in the next week she's screwing somebody. And the blacks, the black men, they'll just be like, oh yeah, with you with that girl now? Yeah, I was with her last week. Yeah, you know, the concept of owning that woman, looking after that woman, protecting that woman, being jealous of that woman, is just simply not. It's not there. That's why, I mean, I did a whole video about this, which is quite amusing, called, because I have a friend who, anyway, I'm not going to tell you the story, but anyway, I did a whole video about it. But I mean, my argument was that ultimately white women, yeah, like you say, they get attracted to them because they have these so-called alpha male qualities, but they're never going to find a deep sense of love and real emotional bonding with a person like that, because they're just not capable. Because what does love mean? Love means you're jealous of that person and you want to protect them, and that they're yours. You know, they belong to you, and you protect them and you look after them. That's what love is. That's how it manifests it. And black people just don't do that. So.
They have an overconfidence as well. I mean, this has been proved that they have a much higher opinion of themselves than they actually are. I mean, they've done psychological tests on Negroes, and they will always think that they've done far, far better in the exam that you've just given them than they actually do. It's just the way they are. So they come across as far more confident than the shy white male. It's just obvious, really, when you look at all the differences in the animal world, the different ways that the animals behave, and then you look at all the differences between the human races, and you think, well, these races are going to have differences between them as well. They're going to behave in different ways, and we should be studying that. We should be learning from that. And we used to. That's what anthropology was all about. It was about going out and studying these different races and these different tribes and learning about humanity and all the different types of it. And if you do study those, then you can capitalize on them. It's like white people, we naturally build civilizations. We naturally have one wife that we protect for and provide for, and they bring up a family, and that's what our nations are based upon, is that one unit. And the hierarchy that you have within the family is the hierarchy that you have within the state, with the king and all his courtiers underneath him, and his witan that are underneath him. It's this hierarchical system that you have. And then when you look at another race like the Negroes, and they have this communal system where they just pass the women around. And you can, again, we can see this from what's happened in America after they freed the Negro. Because while the Negro was a slave, he looked up to the white man and he wanted to be like the white man. And occasionally the white man would let the Negroes get married, and they'd have a marriage ceremony. Of course, they couldn't properly be married because they were the property of the of the slave owner. But they wanted to get married because they wanted to emulate the white man, because they saw that the white man was above them. He was something that they should be striving to imitate. So all the while that the Negro was a slave, you actually had marriages and you actually had these Negroes that would keep together, but it was only because they were copying the white man. And as soon as you said to the, they said to the Negro, right, you're free now and you're equal to the white man, all these divorces just went straight through the roof. And now you've got a 85 to 90% rate of single parents amongst the Negroes in America. They're never going to stick together in a marriage ceremony, because it's not a natural part of their way of thinking. It's not a part of their culture. It's the white man's culture. It was only when they were trying to be like the white man that they used to do that. It's the same as with Haiti. As soon as you take the white man away from Haiti, then the economy falls apart, the country falls apart, and you get famine. Same as we've got famine in Africa at the moment, four countries in Africa. As soon as you take the white man off the scene, the Negro always reverts back to his natural state, his wild state. And I dare say you get the same with China. If you look at the Chinese, the way they are, this system that they have where they're all working for the guys at the top, and the nation is just looked at like a huge factory of all these workers working to produce money. They're not looked at as anything other than economic units, how much money that these people can earn. It's a very communistic system, whereas we have a hierarchical system that's based on nature, because that's what comes natural to the white man. Communism doesn't come natural to us. That had to be introduced by these Jews, deliberately introduced for us in order to put them at the top, carrying out the instructions in the Talmud that the Gentiles will serve the Jews. And how to go about that. I mean, that's all the Talmud is just instructions on how to take over the Gentile lands, take over the Gentile nations, and put the Jews at the top. I don't know if you want to go into any more of this, Subal, because we haven't actually gone into the subject that I know you wanted to talk about this week.
That's once okay. Again. That happens every week. So don't... It took us like 3 weeks to get round to the comic thing, so it'll probably take us 3 weeks to talk about Morgoth, you know.
Well, it's, I think, what have we got? We've got a little bit of time here.
It's all right. We're just rambling. I think people like it when we ramble, so it's okay. How much time we got?
We got 10 minutes. I mean, we wanted to talk a little bit about contributions.
We did, yeah.
I mean, you get content creators, people like me and Subal and Radio Aryan hosts that put a lot of time into producing content for nationalists, people that write, that spend a lot of time writing articles, researching articles, and putting out all this information for nationalists. The same as we get people that go out and go on these protests. And we've got people that are anonymous that do a lot of work in the background, and you've got people that put their faces out there, people like Jez Turner, who's very well known as a face for nationalism. And then we've got the consumers that consume all the content, that are learning from what they hear and from what they read, and they might want to contribute, but they're not quite able to for whatever reason. Either they're not able to put their face out there, they don't want to have their name associated with it, they don't want their voice to be associated with it, they're worried that they might lose their job, or they're worried that their family might be attacked, or maybe they just don't feel confident enough to, or competent enough to produce content. But they can still help, because we all need money in this movement, especially people that are producing articles. And Morgoth wants to be able to work on his site full time. He can only write one or two articles a week, because it takes the time to do that. And because of that, we are missing out on a lot of really well thought out articles, which will be useful in ammunition for bringing people around to our cause. Now, I know you've had some ideas about this, about how we can help Morgoth fund his site, I think, Subal.
Yeah, I personally just think it's a matter of organization and basic generosity. And you know, like I said last week, I'm putting my money where my mouth is. So I am now donating £10 a month to Morgoth on PayPal or whatever it is. So that, so and as far as my maths goes, if 200 people did that, then that would be £2,000 a month, and that would be £24,000 a year, which would give you a basic income. Now, you could argue that, you know, that's a lot. I mean, that's more money than I've ever made in my life, because I'm just a dropout. But you could, I mean, Morgoth could probably survive on £18,000 a year at a bare level. But I mean, I personally think a white nationalist intellectual should be in a position to raise a family, or, I mean, I don't know what Morgoth's personal position is, but £24,000 seems like a fair number to me. I mean, also, you have to consider what we want to do is we want to create an intellectual group, an intellectual core. And so we're going to need people that can get on a plane and fly to a conference or drive around the country and have some speaking events or whatever. But anyway, I'm just putting that out there as a number. I don't know how many people read Morgoth Review's blog. I'm guessing if you look at the comment section, every single article he does, you get at least 250 comments. So maybe he's got like 500 dedicated readers, maybe 2,000-3,000 who every now and again, I don't know. So I'm just saying, if you do read Morgoth Review's blog, I'm sure people do donate to him already, but the point is you have to reach a certain threshold. There's a certain, you know, line that has to be crossed where you can go from doing it part-time to doing it full-time. And people are just going to have to step up to the plate and donate the cash. I mean, this is just, I feel it's something that we don't talk about in white nationalism enough, probably because of humility and embarrassment. I am certainly very embarrassed about asking for donations for myself or for Radio Aerie, and I'm sure Sven feels the same. And this is why I'm asking to donate for Morgoth Reviews. Really, I mean, it's the idea is first Morgoth, right? Get 200 people to set him up so he can go full time, and then maybe next after him, Jez Turner, right? And then next after him, Sven and Radio Aryan, and then next after him, the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And if you just do the maths in your head, let's say you got 1,000 people, they could support 5 bloggers or political activists full time. 2,000 people, that's 10. 3,000 people, that's 15. And imagine that, 15 full time white nationalist political activists in the country. All people really have to do is dig into their pocket and make the donation and get organ. And I don't believe it's because of a lack of generosity at all, because I'm sure most people will be more than willing to donate. I think the problem is there's just a lack of push from content creators, probably because we're embarrassed to ask for money, basically. But we can't be embarrassed. We're not in a position to be embarrassed, because unless we get this ball rolling, unless we get 10, 15, 20, 30 people full time pushing our cause, we're not going to win the fight. And we have to save the country and we have to save the white race. So there's nothing really to be embarrassed about. Yeah, Sven.
Well, it's sponsorship, isn't it? I mean, we haven't got advertising, we can't have advertising, so we require sponsorship. And if Morgoth has got 500 readers of the blog, say, regular readers, if they were just to put £1 a week in, that would be £2,000 a month. That's really good money. And I would say you probably only need 1,000 a month to get by on. 1,200, yeah, about 1,000 a month, depending on what part of the country you're living in. And then you've got somebody that can do for 40 hours a week. So that would be, what, 250 people putting in a pound a week. And you've got your £1,000 a month to cover your rent, your food, and your living costs, and then somebody can write full time.
Just to interrupt. I mean, the idea why I'm saying 200 people, and I'm putting that number out there, is we have to develop some, because random donations are just not going to do it. If you want to go full time, you need to know that there is a set group of people, and they are your core supporters, and they are going to put money in your bank account every month. That's the only way you can do it. Random donations are just, I mean, it's all very good, but it's just not enough. So what we need to do is persuade about 200 people, depending on the amount. I mean, I'm just putting these numbers out there as an idea. But we need to persuade a certain core group of people that have this idea that, okay, Morgoth is my responsibility. That is my job to look after him. And if I don't put money in his bank account every week or every month, then, you know, he's going to have a problem. So he's mine. There should be a connection there. You see what I mean? Like an ownership, like the way that, I don't know, a father looks after a child or whatever. Like, you know, it's, there needs to be that kind of that bond of generosity. Like, I am going to look after this person. That's why I'm promoting Morgoth. I mean, the idea is that first of all, we set up one person, put him up there. He's crossed the threshold. We've got a certain number of people looking after him. Okay, donation drive finished. Morgoth review is set up, and then we can move on to the next. You know, like Jez Turner, perhaps, who has financial difficulties at the moment, as far as I understand it. Set him up. Okay, he's done. And then a donation drive for the next one, and a donation drive for the next one. And like that. And then we have an intellectual core for the movement. And without this, with this intellectual core, without these bloggers, without these people writing the things that they do and talking about the things that they do. I mean, I gotta say also, it takes a long time to just educate yourself. I spent all my time reading, and there's a lot of books that have got to be read in order to fully understand the subject matter that we're dealing with. So yeah, that's what we need. We need people to step up and say they're gonna take responsibility for Morgoth's review.
Yeah, it's important. Important role that we play, I think, producing the content for people, because you can't spend all your time reading as well. You can get a lot more into a podcast, I think, because you can summarize what other people have already learned, and then you can get up to speed. The only problem with it I can think of is with PayPal, once they find out that it's a nationalist account, then they get rid of the account. But we've got Bitcoin, so what needs to be looked at, I think, is finding a Bitcoin provider that will do recurring donations. And then you could set that up so that there was recurring donations going into a Bitcoin account, because that's the problem. Because otherwise you'd have to be putting in £1 a week in Bitcoin, or £10 a month in Bitcoin, or whatever the amount was. So that's something maybe people might be able to help out in the comments and suggest a good Bitcoin provider that does recurring donations. And also, while you're thinking about it, while you're thinking about donations, don't forget we do also have overheads here at Radio Aryan, as well as at Morgoth's Review. Okay, I think we've finished for this week, Subal. Thank you very much for coming on once again. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week, same time, same place, on Radio Aryan. And we hope you have a wonderful week ahead of you.
Alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.